This is Jim Mackin conducting an interview with Terry Dunphy of Butte, Montana. The interview is at Terry's house, and it's Friday, the 29th of October, 2010. So, let's get some basic biographical stuff out of the way here. First, what's your name?
Terrence L. Dunphy.
And where and when were you born?
I was born in 1939 in a house at 413 North Washington Street in Butte. And it was actually the same house my mother was born in.
Okay. And Washington Street is uptown, right?
Correct. 400 block on North Washington is above the mother lode, 4 or 5 blocks north of that.
Okay. And where did you grow up?
So I grew up on North Washington and North Idaho Street and went to St. Patrick's Grade School.
Okay. How close was St. Patrick's Grade School to where you lived?
About 5 blocks. It was right across the street from the Mother Lode Theater. That was St. Patrick's Grade School.
Okay.
We had the YMCA and the St. Patrick's Grade School across the street from each other.
Mm-hmm.
The miners got a discount for their kids to belong to the Y. It was like $6 for probably the year to belong to the Y.
Wow.
So after school, we'd run over there and go swimming or play basketball or whatever.
Where have you lived since then?
I've lived at, after I come out of the service, 1032 South Wyoming Street in Butte.
Okay.
And I lived up at Basin Creek Reservoir, south of Butte. I had 5 acres up there. And then I've lived at Georgetown Lake for a couple of years and lived here for the last 13 years.
Okay. And here, just to clarify, is...
Everything's in Butte. I've never, yes. Other than Georgetown Lake, which was 48 miles west of here.
This is 91
Wathena.
Wathena.
Wathena Drive.
Okay. Well, what jobs have you had?
I worked for Safeway Stores after I came out of the service as a warehouseman. And while I was working there, I took accounting courses from LaSalle University correspondence.
Mm-hmm.
When I got my accounting degree from them, I went to work for Universal Car Loading and Distributing in Butte, which was a division of U.S. Freight.
Okay.
And it distributed railroad cars would come in and unload their freight, and we would have the bills and set them up for delivery to wherever they were going to. And when they shut their offices down here, then I went to work for Anaconda Company.
Okay.
And I worked there out the Berkeley Pit in the garage as a clerk. And I kept track of the mileage on the tires and the fuel used on the big trucks.
Mm-hmm.
Then they went on strike, and while they were on strike, Montana Power called me, and I went to work for Montana Power.
Okay. About what years are we talking about?
Okay. Roughly. I came out of the service in 1960. I worked for Universal Car Loading Safeway till 66. Universal Car Loading until 70. I worked for Anaconda Company for 1 year and went to work for the power company in 71.
Okay.
And then I retired from the power company in 1996.
Oh, so you spent 25 years with
them. Yeah. And I was director of payroll when I retired. I went in as a clerk in the accounting department and retired as director of payroll.
Okay. In 96, it was still Montana Power, huh?
Right.
Okay. It says, what do you do for a living now? You're retired, actually.
I'm retired.
And
an occasional bartender.
Okay. So, some part-time bartending.
After I retired, I went into the real estate business for a couple of years.
Did you do that?
Yeah, I got my real estate license. One of the girls that I bought my place up at Georgetown Lake, and mm-hmm. She was telling me she needed a realtor, so I went and took the test and passed it. I had my license. I was with her for about 3 weeks, and she upped and left town. So then I went to work for Great Divide Realty for a couple of years.
Oh, Great Divide, yeah. You're married?
Married.
And I might as well get your wife's name.
Her name is Patricia Lynn. She was also born in Butte and went to St. Patrick's grade school also.
Were you there at the same time?
No, I was nine years older than her.
Okay.
But she was there at the same time my sister. Her and my sister were real good friends.
What age were you when you married?
My first time.
Oh, okay. Yeah, let's cover them both.
Then. Okay, I got married when I came out of the service in 1961. And I was married until 1979.
Okay.
Two children. And we got divorced and I got remarried in April of 1980.
Okay, so you've been married to Patricia then since
1980.
For
30 plus years.
Okay. Is Patricia also of Irish ancestry?
Yes. Her mother was a Crosby. Maiden name was... it was Hazel Crosby was her maiden name. Her parents were Joel, I can't remember her grandmother's name. He was a railroad man out of Rocker, Montana.
Okay.
And they were raised there. And her father was a Robinson, also a railroad man.
Okay. All right. You have two children by your first marriage?
Two by my first. And two stepchildren.
Okay, and two stepchildren by your second marriage.
Right.
Okay. So. When did your ancestors leave Ireland?
Probably. I know my grandmother and grandfather, the Whalens, were both born in Butte.
Mm-hmm.
And I know my great-grandfather was born and raised in Ireland. He'd never left Ireland. So I don't know when the kids came over. Murphy, Julia Murphy, well, she was born in Butte, so they had to leave. As far back as I got, Peter Lynch was my great-grandfather. Peter Murphy married Nellie Lynch. Their daughter, Julia Murphy, was my grandmother. She married Ed Whalen.
Okay.
And then Ed Whalen and Julia Murphy, and my mother was from that union, and her name was Helen Whalen. So it was Murphy's, Whalen's.
So from the Murphys to the Whalens, were they all in Butte at the time?
Yes.
So you don't know when their ancestors...
No, I assume they might have been, because I know in 1829 when Peter Murphy got married, he was in Ireland. So somewhere between 1829 and probably when the famine hit, you know, they might have came over at that point.
Sounds about the famine time.
Right.
Do you know where they left from? You know anything
about
where?
Castletown Bear. County Cork, Ireland.
Okay. Do you know anything at all about their lives in Ireland?
No, they're minors. I have a cousin that's still alive in Ireland. Her name is Sister Margaret Murphy. And she's the one that sent us the breakdown of the family tree and everything and how many kids everybody had. Of course, they're spread all over the world in Australia and Ireland and London and...
Yeah.
Canada.
So they were miners in the copper mining Cork.
Right.
Not in Southwest Cork. Is it Barrow Peninsula or
something? Right. Exactly. Where's that? Yeah, on the peninsula.
Okay. What does your Irish ancestry mean to you?
Unfortunately, when I was growing up, it didn't mean that much because nobody in the family really talked about it or spoke about it. It was after I became an adult that I realized what it was, you know, and then it became very close and very important to me. That's why I joined the Hibernians and started studying a little more about Irish history and trying to figure out exactly where my ancestry was, and just became very proud of what the Irish have contributed to the country.
Yeah.
You know, when you look at Governor Maher, Governor Montana, and what he went through coming from Australia, from the prison camp, you know. So,
right.
Yeah, it's been a real good education for me.
So, about what age did you start getting interested in your Irish heritage?
Well, I would say it was probably somewhere in my mid-40s where I really got in. I had two uncles, James Patrick Whalen, Martin Vincent Whalen. I told you, James Patrick went by the nickname of Swede. Martin Vincent went by the nickname of Dutch. So my two uncles were Swede and Dutch. That's all I ever knew them by. But Swede always told me, if anybody asks what you are, you tell them you're Irish Catholic Democrat, which I thought was one word till I was 17 years old. So, and I, there again, you know, I never really gave much thought to it. I remember I had a high school teacher who called, when I had a report to another teacher, he's wrote a note to the other teacher saying, give this young harp, such and such, you know, and I didn't even know what he was referring to when he called me young harp. And things like that just went right over my head. I remember when I was dating a girl in California, and I told them I was Irish, and her parents asked me, does that mean you're Catholic, because most Irish are Catholic, and I told them yes. Fortunately, they were Catholic, and they were looking for a Catholic boy for their daughter. So, and there, you know, I never realized that all Irish, most Irish were Catholic. I just... So it was later in life when I started really looking into things to find out exactly what was going on. So
there weren't, in your family, there weren't stories about the family coming over from Ireland or any of that?
No, there wasn't any of that.
So do you have any idea where they settled first?
I think, according to, like, say, Swede and Martin were probably the only source I really had about the family, because my mother and her sisters, they didn't really talk about it that much. But it sounded to me like they, when they came to the U.S., they came from New York to Butte, because they had relatives in New York, Whalens. Mm-hmm. And I remember them talking about their relatives. They're on the police force or fire department in New York, and their names were Whalens. And in fact, they had pictures of them. They corresponded back and forth. But that was all I ever heard them ever talk about, was they had ancestries and relatives in New York. So.
So they came from New York to Butte, and why did they come to Butte?
I imagine for the work, where most of them came from, because Marcus Daly had the mines, and it was pretty much open invitation. When you hit New York, come on out to Butte, we have work for you. So I'm sure this was back in the 1800s now when they would have come out here, so.
Yeah. That would have... with Marcus Daly, we're talking about 1880, 1890,
right.
Somewhere around there, yeah. With those opportunities.
My mother was one of eight kids. It was four girls and four boys in their family.
Mm-hmm.
And her father passed away at age 40. It was 1915, and she was only 5 years old. She was born in 1910. And then she had a sister who was younger than her, who incidentally is still alive, Edna O'Brien, her name is. And she's just like 90. Oh, she just passed away this summer. So
they lost their father when they were both very young.
Right, yeah.
And do you know how they got along? Have you ever heard anything about those stories about that?
No, I know my mother and her two sisters. One was Alice, and she had gotten killed in a car wreck on Woodville. They're going down by Boulder there in Basin. And I remember Alice when I was little, always being at the house. Edna O'Brien and my mother and their husbands, they all got along. We always went on vacation and picnic and that party. She lost and then Sweet Nan. Yeah, her brothers were real close to her, Mark. They were, in fact, Mark lived with us off and on from time to time. He never did marry. The oldest one, there was an older sister, Carrie, and an older sister, Ted, and they were both dead by the time I was born. They died.
Mm-hmm. So, we briefly mentioned your last name, Dunphy, and could you say what you know about the origins of your name?
Yeah, well, the Dunphys, my father was actually born in Pittsburgh, Kansas. And he left with his mother and brother when he was 3 years old. His mother had a brother up in Roundup, Montana, and she came up to Roundup with the two kids. So my dad was raised by his uncle in Roundup. And after he became an adult, he went to work driving bus in Yellowstone Park. Then he met my mother. They had a bakery for a while, and then he came to Butte to work in the mines. But as far as the family history on Dunphy's, in 1813, there was like 14 Dunphy families in the U.S., and they're all in Ohio. Half came from Limerick, half came from Liverpool, and then they branched out from there. I know my grandfather, my dad's father, his name was Clarence. He's buried in Pittsburgh, Kansas. He remarried and then died down there. Mm-hmm. I've talked to some of his offspring, got together before. And kind of a coincidence, because we always said we're of Indian descent, my father's gravestone says Monroe Buck Dunphy. His father's tombstone in Kansas says Clarence Chief Dunphy. So, might not be far wrong.
So the Dunphy's side of your family came to the States earlier.
Yeah, I would imagine they were in early 1800s, as far back as I can tell. And I know that, like I say, my grandfather, Clarence, lived all his life in Pittsburgh, Kansas.
So, sure.
And that's where he raised his family and second family.
Yeah, and then they came to Roundup.
Yeah, and then my father came with his mother after they split and up to Roundup. And
so you're on the Dunphy side. You didn't have a lot of stories about coming from Ireland or any of that.
In fact, I wasn't sure Dunphy was even Irish until we had this brother that taught at Central, Boys Central, and his name was Brother Dunphy. And he gave me a little insight into what the Dunphy name was, and he told me it was from County Mayo, and that's where the Dunphys originated at.
So then and the spelling of the name had changed.
Yes, yeah, it was P-H-Y. His name was P-H-Y. So.
Yeah. Are there any traditional first names or nicknames in your family?
Not traditional names, but everybody has a nickname. Seemed like, you know, like my father was Buck Dunphy, the Whalens were Swede and Dutch, and my brother is named after my dad. His name is Charles Monroe, but he's been Skip all his life. It's all we've ever known him by was Skip.
But there's no carrying on other than the Chief and Buck.
Yeah, and James Patrick, who was Swede, my brother, I have a brother, Jim, who was named after him. So, but that's really the only one that I can think of that's got the family.
So the nicknames are, seem to be more typical of Butte than they do of, you know, Irish nicknames or things
Yeah,
like that.
I mean, growing up, everybody had a nickname, right?
That
even in, you know, in grade school, I can remember I was called Flash. Everybody called me Flash Dunphy. And everybody had a nickname, you know. Even if it was like McCaughey, he went by Mac. Even if it was that short of a name, you know, I mean, everybody seemed to have some kind of a nickname that we always went by.
Okay, but they weren't particularly Irish nicknames.
No.
That or something that would have come from Ireland. Tell me about your childhood growing up on Washington.
It was pretty much an all-Irish neighborhood, which I didn't realize until afterwards when I grew up. On one corner, seemed to be the mainstay of the neighborhood, was the Warren family. Jack Warren. Jack was an engineer with the Anaconda Copper Mining Company. Had a real good job. Right directly across the street was O'Leary's. Barry O'Leary was the mayor of Butte.
Oh, okay.
So we had the mayor and this engineer. Then next door, we had Frazier, Hook Frazier. Hook, another nickname. Hook was the bartender at the Finland Hotel. And then McCaughey's, who was miners. Adams were miners. Lavelle's, I'm not sure what Lavelle's did. Then next to us, we had Ryan's. Ryan was a timekeeper with the mines. And then next to him was the O'Leary's. And then on the corner was Riley's, miners. across the alley from them was Keller's. So as I look back, the whole neighborhood was all Irish. You know, my friends that I ran around with, Joe Harrington lived down the block, Ralph McCaughey, well, we had an Olenek. Olenek was in there too. He wasn't Irish. But that was pretty much, like I say, it was all Irish neighborhood that we ran around. Freeborns, yeah, let's see, Garvey's, Freeborns, McCaughey, Dunphy's, and just a lot of Irish kids that were around. So.
And was this the Nanny Goat Hill area?
Nanny Goat Hill is where we moved in 1950.
Okay.
We were raised on North Washington, and the next block was Idaho. And that's where my father bought a house finally in 1950, and then we moved to that house. And it was, you know, like say, you go out the back door of Washington, you hit the back door of the one on Idaho Street that was just that close. But yeah, they call that Nanny Goat Hill. Whenever we said, you know, where you live at, on North Idaho Street, up on Nanny Goat Hill. And, yeah.
That's, I guess, for people that don't understand that, besides being one big hill, there's this little hill.
Right,
on,
yeah.
On the hill. On
it was
the way.
Probably the steepest street in the town at that time. You had a, you know, you couldn't go up it in the wintertime, that's for sure. And you, then you had a big rock wall where you could only go so far anyway, and then they had wooden steps that you'd go up to get on top, or you could drive all the way around. It was about three or four blocks out of the way to come around it.
And it was, well, did you, what kind of games did you play as children?
Everything was outdoors. We were really involved in, well, you kick the can, of course. There was a big mine dump there, and it had a telephone pole off the edge of it, and we'd seal ropes from the mines, and then we'd make a big rope swing. A black rock baseball field that we played baseball in. So it was pretty much, we were either playing football, baseball, kick the can, you know, everything was outdoor sports. And, you know, we traveled, we had bikes, we traveled all over. You know, nobody seemed to care where we're at as long as we're home by dark. You know, we'd get off to school and take off, and by dark we had to be home. My father had a distinct whistle that everybody in the neighborhood could hear, you know, miles away it seemed like. And when he whistled, it was time to head for home, so.
No.
I'll tell you one interesting story.
Yeah.
My father made me a rubber gun. Rubber guns were big things. He used to make them out of, put a clothespin and rubber out of inner tubes, and you can shoot these big, thick rubbers, you know, and everybody had a rubber gun. Well, I didn't, so my father decided to make me one. He made me a rubber gun, and it wouldn't shoot worth a darn, and the kids were laughing at it. So I went home with tears in my eyes, told them the kids were laughing at my rubber gun. Now, I'm probably 6-7 years old. He strapped on his .22 pistol on my waist, and here, go out and play with that, see him laugh at this. And I'm out there, everybody else got the rubber gun, and I've got a .22 pistol strapped on me. Fortunately, it wasn't loaded. Yeah, but that's how he was. You know, here, go out and have him laugh at this. So I was out packing the gun.
So most of the toys you played with and things like that were you made yourself?
Yeah, this was, you know, we didn't even have TV until I was probably in the seventh or eighth grade in grade school. So, prior to those years, I mean, it was all, everything was outdoors. We were playing, played chase in the neighborhood, kick the can, we'd divide up football teams, play football. Neighbors two blocks down had a grass lawn. We'd run down there, or the courthouse had a grass lawn. We'd go to the courthouse, and that was our football field. You know.
But you mentioned your baseball was on a black...
Black. It's called Virginia Street Rink. And it's right there where Woman Street comes down and goes on to Jackson. There's a big circle. There was a big black rink there. And it was just black rock. And that's what we played in. And then in the wintertime, the city would come by and they'd flood it. And then we'd use it for an ice skating rink. And also, then, you know, everybody had big bonfires. You know, and you'd go steal Christmas trees from somebody, and every gang collected their trees that was thrown away by the people. And then the more trees you had, the bigger the bonfire you'd go, or the longer you'd keep one going. And we used to go around and we'd raid other Christmas trees. People would raid our trees. It wasn't really nothing mischievous as far as let's go damage something, you know. It was.
Now, when you say gangs, you mean neighborhood groups.
Right.
And were they based on the neighborhood itself, or was it based on, say, the school you went to?
It was pretty much on the neighborhood, because where I lived was right between, it was called the Virginia Street Gang, and actually most of the people on Virginia Street went to St. Mary's, where Washington and Woman went to St. Pat's. So schools had no bearing on it. It was just where the neighborhood was at, where you were, what rink you were affiliated with. The okay. North Side was all St. Mary's, and Washington grade school. And that was a big rink on the North Side. What was nice about that rink is that it had a big metal pipe run alongside of it, steam pipe, what was used for the mines or something. But you could, you had your ready-made, go and sit down on the steam pipe and keep warm all the time. You know? Yeah. And it was hot enough, I can remember, by getting chunks of ice, and where the bolts were, you could melt ice on the bolts. That's how hot it was. You know, you'd stick it up there and it'd melt a big hole in the ice. So
give you a donut ice.
Yeah.
Did you use sleds and things?
We used a sled. Everybody had sleds. And same thing, we'd start on top of Idaho Street and end up down below the Anselmo Mine on Copper Street. Just go all the way around down Washington, take a right on Copper, and then go all the way down to the bottom of Copper. And
could you go down the steep hill on the Nanico?
Yeah, well, you could, but you had to watch where you were going, because part of the hills, like Court Street, the main streets, east and west, quartz and granite, were well sanded. So you had to watch where you're going on your sled. If you hit that sand, then you'd really get come to a grinding halt. You know, you'd keep going, the sled would stop. So Copper Street, Washington and Copper, they didn't sand for some reason. And you could sled that all year round. In fact, we had some great skiers that back then, besides sledding, they'd ski. And then as they got older, Sheila Penaluna is one that comes to mind, who became a great skier. Mm-hmm. She used to ski just when she was little down that hill because she didn't have a sled.
Oh, is that?
Yeah. So get up and take the skis and go away they go.
So it wasn't just snow, it was ice down there.
Well, after you went down, we used to hook cars, you know, you'd hook car bumpers and go all over where you could see how far you could go on the car bumpers. Mm-hmm. In those days when the trains were running and they'd go out to Anaconda, you could actually go up on North Montana Street where they just had it all torn up. There was a trestle there. Mm-hmm. Stand on that trestle and jump into an ore car coming under the trestle there and take it all the way, jump off at Gregson, which wasn't Fairmont, then it was Gregson Hot Springs, mm-hmm. and you jump off at Gregson Hot Springs. Now, there were stories about kids jumping the train coming back. I've never done that, but we used to hitchhike back there. You get on the road and start thumbing, you know, and thumb home. Hmm. But we'd ride the train out there. Hell yeah, you'd go up and jump off the trestle and jump onto the ore car and ride it all the way to Gregson. And then they had the Columbia Gardens also. You know, you had them back then too. And they had Children's Day where you eat on the buses. And every Thursday, Children's Day, free bus rides. And
The Columbia Gardens Center were packed with kids.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, just, you know. And the boardwalk, they had this huge, big boardwalk where all the shops and stores, and they had not video games, but they had gaming things. And you could play in there, and, you know, I can remember catching, I'd like have like 25 cents and head for the gardens, and that'd be enough to get you a cotton candy, peanuts, or and a pop, you know, as long as you had your quarter.
Do you recall whether there were any of those of the traditional Gaelic games played when you were young?
No, not unless it was something like chase or kick the can. I'm not sure what that's. Yeah, yeah.
But there wasn't any Gaelic football hurling or anything like that going on.
No, I didn't have any of that.
Okay.
It's funny because all the kids that I was raised up there, and they were all Irish families, and I can remember even a couple of the ladies having brogues. Mm-hmm. But it was never discussed, you know.
Interesting.
Nobody talked about the Irish, their heritage. Nobody tried to tell us anything about it, you know.
Not much. You said you didn't have TV until you were older.
Yeah.
And so was there any tradition of entertainment in the house of, say, storytelling, singing?
No, we had entertainment. My uncle, Dutch Whalen, was a piano player, and we had a piano. Mm-hmm. And my father was a great musician. He played harmonica, accordion, piano, drums. So it seemed like they'd have little impromptu jam sessions going. You know, we'd go on picnics or campfire or up on vacation. We'd go to Swan Lake, for instance, for a week during the summertime. And it seemed like, you know, no matter where we're at, my dad was always on the harmonica, or if there was in a house or somebody was playing the piano, my uncle the same way. He was always, you know, kids in the neighborhood used to just come up and listen to Mark play the piano. Summertime, you'd have the doors wide open because he used to really pound on that piano.
So you had a strong musical tradition.
Yeah,
that you
my mother played piano also. Yeah, that's probably why we had the piano, because of her.
What kind of music did they play?
It seems to me, Mark Dutch, he, I guess, would be considered hard rock now, because it was really, it wasn't big band sounds. You know, it was really...
Maybe ragtime or something?
Yeah, maybe it was probably more ragtime stuff. My father, he played whatever you could play on a harmonica, I guess, in the accordion. You know, it was pretty much polka style. He loved a polka.
Oh.
And he was a great dancer. He'd always dance no matter where he was at. He danced right to the time he died almost. But yeah, it's just, you know, they had, back then, almost every weekend in the summer, some bar was sponsoring a picnic. You'd have the Elks picnic, you'd have the Met picnic, you know, a KC picnic. And that's what we did. Everybody went on picnics, you know, and you bought your own food and everything, your own booze, whatever beer and that they were drinking, you know, and then they'd go on these picnics. And they had various picnic grounds all around Butte, you know, up there on past Woodville on the way to, there was like three of them going just on that highway, the old highway there. And they had the tables and the fire pits and the creek going down there, and everybody went on picnics. And
they had music at the picnics?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Martin Merkel had a band here in Butte, and I can remember one of the Met picnics, because my dad jumped in there and started playing. At the Met picnics, it would be like a jam session. I mean, everybody that could play music would bring something. And they're always, they had music going constantly all day long, you know. And Merkel played the trumpet, and they'd have the trumpet players and the drummers and a couple of horn players, and then my dad, they'd have accordion players. And
You mentioned polkas. Did you ever hear any Irish music, jigs, or dancing to the step dance?
Not until I got older, and you know, things like river dance, and they started coming along, and then you got involved with it. It hurried up. In fact, I went to Vegas to see Riverdance. And I guess I'm trying to think back in school. We used to have plays every year in school. And we had dances too, but nobody... I can kind of remember somebody doing an Irish dance. Because I just remember the hands being straight up and down. I don't know if that was... Probably Glenn Shaw or Wilda Hazen, one of them would know, because they were the... more inclined to be dancers than anybody else. Everybody else was scruffy little buggers, you know, they're all...
So this was for a school show?
Yeah, they had, every class had a play. Every year, the kindergarten had a rhythm band, you know, and they played. Remember, they had the triangles and all that, yeah. So, and then you would have, like, first, second grades, they might put on a play, and third grade, fourth grade. Every class had a play. And then they had their big picture taken, you know, like we put on Once Upon a Clothesline, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, and Peter Pan. I remember those were the plays that we all put on in grade school. So,
What was your housing like? Your house in Washington and then your house in...
The house in Washington was actually a four-room house. It had a front room and a bedroom. It was almost like a closet or a hallway between the kitchen and the front room, and that was my brother's, that was our sleeping quarters. We slept on a sleeping bag in there. And then there was the kitchen, and then another bedroom, and the other bedroom was where the girls slept. So we had five kids. There was three boys and two girls. And then that was Washington Street. Well, then in 1950, actually Gino wasn't born yet, but in 1950, that's when my dad bought the house on North Idaho Street. And we knew the people that owned it. Their names were Osborne, and it was a big upstairs, downstairs. The upstairs was used as a duplex, even though it only had one entrance. But it had a separate kitchen and stuff in it. And so when they bought that house, then it just, the whole house became like it was meant to be one house. So that had three bedrooms in it. So that was really good. My brother and I each had a bedroom, and then the girls had a bedroom, and my mom and dad's bedroom. Then they had the front room, the kitchen, the pantry,
So that was larger.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was quite a bigger house. On Washington Street, we strictly rented. We rented. I remember it was like $25 a month rent. I remember they had brass lanterns that came down off the ceiling that came down and were curved.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad was going to get a new, you know, at that time was just right up against the ceiling type light. So he took the brass lights down, and I remember the landlord going crazy over it because he took those lights down without permission.
Oh.
And they were having a big argument over it.
But didn't you say that was the house where your mother...
No, this was on 414. 413 was across the street. That's where we were born.
Oh, okay. So you were born across the street.
Yeah. There was Warren's, and then this little house, 413, and that's where I was born. And then after, when World War II broke out, my mother's sister and her husband, he was in the service, and they lived over on Gagne Street behind St. Mary's. We moved over there for a year or so is all.
Mm-hmm.
And then the mines went on strike, then we moved to Missoula. I actually went to first grade in Missoula. We were there for about a year. Then when we moved back, it was 414 North Washington. So yeah, I forgot that. We lived in Missoula for during 1946. Because when they came back from the war and the mines were on strike, then my dad went to the railroad in Missoula and worked on the railroad.
Okay, and so...
And we rented down there.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to the first grade there, and then we came back to Butte. He wasn't down there very long, because I can remember going to first grade there, but we must have moved back as soon as we got out of school.
When your house, well, by the time the youngest one was born,
Gina was, there was, would have been four children and my mom and dad in the house on Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Skip was born in 35, I'm 39, Jim was 45, Lynn was 49, and then they didn't buy their other house till in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And that was because he was promoted from a miner to a shift boss. He became a shift boss at that time. So they bought a bigger house. And my youngest sister was born in 55. So there's 20 years between my brother and my sister.
Yeah.
So if you look, it's 35, 39, 45, 49, 55, 59 escaped. She didn't have any baby in 59, but...
So when you were growing up, how did you work out chores? I mean, you were kind of spread out a bit there, weren't you?
Yeah, we didn't have much choice. I remember my older brother and I, you know, fighting over who was going to dry the dishes and who was going to wash dishes. We had dishes to wash and wipe. There really wasn't a question about who was going to do it. We knew it had to get done, and one of us was going to do it because my dad didn't give us a choice, you know. We had to go out and shovel the driveway for his car, shovel the walks, the porch, the steps, and all that. We had to do dishes. The only thing I don't remember us having to do was make our own beds or anything.
Was that right?
Yeah. I can remember getting up and going to school, and then we come home, the bed would be made, you know, and we never made our own beds, but we did a lot of chores as far as who's going to take the garbage out, who's going to do the dishes, and stuff like that.
So it was just assigned to your two older boys,
right,
basically. And
yeah, then my other brother, 45, he was born in 45, so... I would have been six
when he was born.
Yeah, so I guess, well, I know my older brother had a paper route, and this is when he was in grade school, and he kept the paper route through high school. Then I got the paper route. At that time, I was a freshman. I had it through school and then gave it to my younger brother. So we had, there was three kids in the family that had that paper route.
Same route.
And it's a morning route. I mean, you got up at 5:30, 6 o'clock, packed papers, 20, 25 below zero, and came home and got ready for school.
Use a bike?
Not so much, because it was this stuff, up Montana Street and down Copper Street, you know, you'd be more pushing more than walking.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so you just put the sack of papers on your shoulder and start packing them.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, mine started right there at Courts in Montana, and it went up there to Copper, then you had to go up the steep hill to Copper Street. Down Idaho to Woman, up Woman, and then you had Virginia and Broadway streets, and you'd come back down and had Washington Street. So it was a pretty good walk every morning.
Yeah. Did your father have a car, or did the family have a car?
His first brand new car he ever bought was in 1954. He bought a 54 Pontiac. But other than then, it was all used cars. And yeah, they had cars. He had a 39 Chevy, 39 Pontiac. Cause I remember when he bought the 39 Pontiac, it was a friend of his, Austin, had the very same thing. It was a tan 39 Pontiac. They were identical cars. And then my dad had a 39 Chevy sedan that he cut the back off, built a box on, used that for hunting. He was a great outdoorsman, loved to hunt and fish. So he had the 39, and then he went to a probably late 40s Chevy, 48. And he had a 49 Pontiac. And then in 54, I remember they bought the brand new car. It had papers on the doors when he bought it home. It's 54 Pontiac. So that was his first new car. And then, yeah, he's always had nice cars after that. He liked Chryslers. He had several big Chryslers.
And most of this took place after he had been promoted, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, up to the time when they were renting, and, you know, he had that, like, say, the 39 Pontiac up through the 40s. It wasn't probably until the 50s that he bought a 48 Chevy. Then he had that until he bought the 54 Pontiac. So,
so you went through high school at Butte Central then?
Butte High.
At Butte High. Okay, at Butte High. And after you finished high school, did you go into the military?
I went in before I finished high school.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah, I had dropped out of high school. And when I dropped out, it was at the end of my junior year. Mm-hmm. I didn't have like a month to go or something. And I went to work on a section, which was the railroad, BAMP, the mining railroad. And I worked on that until November. They went on strike. And so I was home through Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's. Right after New Year's, they were still on strike, and I wasn't in school. And my father said, "You're not living here for nothing." I was 17. So he says, "You better either get a job, go back to school, or join the service. But if you're going to join the service, don't go in the Marine Corps. Go in the Coast Guard or Air Force or something." So I said, "Okay." So I went down and joined the Marine Corps January 16th. Fortunately, when I went in the Marine Corps, I'd gotten court-martialed right after boot camp. And it was there was three kinds of court-martial. It was a middle one. General, it wasn't a general one. That was a big one. It was a middle one. Destroying government property. And what that was when I got out of boot camp and they put me in this 9th Motor Transport, they made me a mail clerk. Mm-hmm. Well, some mail was coming in that was for Sergeant Moose, I remember, and he had been discharged and gone back to Michigan. And the mail was from the local Knights of Columbus saying, "Dear sir and brothers, inform you there'll be a meeting such and such." I tore that up, threw it in the wastebasket. Another card come through for another guy that had been out of there, and I do that in the wastebasket. And there was a couple of things like that that I just pitched in the garbage, not thinking anything of it, when the inspector general came through, and one of the things he did was lift up that wastebasket, and out comes his cards. So he says, "You know, it's out of his hands, and got to be court-martialed, that's destruction, you know, mail and all this stuff." So I had a major defend me, and he ended up getting it acquitted. But when he defended me, he says, "You know, 17 years old, did you finish high school?" I said, "No, sir." He's okay. "I'm going to keep you off of mess duty. I'm going to keep you off of guard duty. You got to go back and get your diploma." So that's what I did. I went back to Oceanside Carlsbad Junior College every night.
Got
my diploma, and he kept me, you know, I worked for him in an office, and he kept after me and kept his eye on me like he was my dad. I mean, the whole 3 years I was in the service, I was with him.
So you finished, you got your high school diploma.
Right. I got my high school diploma and a couple of college credits too, you know. Yeah. Yeah.
And so then after you got out of the Marines, then that's when you started taking the LaSalle courses?
No, I got out of the Marines in January and I came home and I went to work for Safeway probably that spring or that summer. And it was after working with them for a couple of years, because I was happier than hell with the job. It was a good job as Teamsters, union paid, you know. But then I realized, started looking, you know, you see, like my father-in-law at that time worked there. He was 49 years old, and he was a broken-down little old man, you know, and that boy, you know, this is tough work. You know? So at that point, I thought, I don't want to do this the rest of my life, so I started the LaSalle correspondent courses. And that probably took me another 3 or 4 years to finish them. And I'd gotten help on that because there was another kid taking accounting courses. Leonard Haxby was an attorney. He was studying to be an attorney. At that time, you didn't need a college degree to take your lawyer's exam or the bar exam. So I was hoping to take the CPA exam at the time, which I didn't get to do. But anyway, when I finished that, the day I finished, I reported off at Safeway, went up the unemployment with my suit on and my little diploma and said, you know, I'm looking for a job. And that was at 8 o'clock when they opened, and by 9:30 I had a job. And that was with U.S. Freight.
Yeah.
Office manager at U.S. Freight.
That's a pretty quick turnaround.
Yes, sir. I gotta go to the bathroom just a minute. Hang on, you're told.
Okay, Terry, we had we just talked about how you completed your education. Did any other members of your family attend college? Or?
Of the five of the kids, none of us did.
Except by your LaSalle courses.
Yeah, and my older brother took LaSalle also. He retired. He was actually manager of the water company, Butte Water Company, when he retired. Jim was a fireman. Lynn worked for the state highway. Gino works for the state bar. And like I say, none of us actually went to college to get a diploma.
So it was the Montana School of Mines here then?
Right, yeah.
And none of your family went to that?
No.
Attended up there. You mentioned belonging to St. Patrick's. And did St. Patrick's, besides having the name, did it appear to be an Irish-American community, or was it just...
No, it was a typical Butte Catholic grade school. Competing in sports was all against other, at that time there was like 10 or 12 Catholic grade schools in town, and we all had our own, it was called, the CYO, had the Catholic Youth Organization. We all had our own leagues that we played against each other's school all the time, whether it's sixth, seventh grade, fifth, sixth grade football, then you went into seventh and eighth, it was like junior varsity and varsity and grade school. And we didn't have, other than St. Patrick's Day off, that we're the only grade school on St. Patrick's Day, we got the day off, where the other Catholic grade schools had to go to school. Because I can remember we used to hold that over them, we got off, we're off school.
So the other schools didn't get off on St.
No,
Patrick's
they didn't get
Day.
Off on St. Patrick's Day. St. Patrick's is the only one.
What kind of celebration was St. Patrick's Day then?
It really wasn't. They didn't have the big parades or anything back then. So I don't remember going to a parade. Like the only parade I remember going to was when I was in grade school would be Bohunkus Day. Bohunkus Day was a big Butte High parade and they used to put on a big deal for that. But we never had any real Irish celebrations on St. Patrick's Day at St. Patrick's grade school.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. So,
what church was were you affiliated with?
The St. Patrick's Catholic Church.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did the church have events?
Nothing. It's as far as Irish goes. You had First Friday, Good Friday. Every First Friday, you had to go to communion. And Monsignor English, he was the only Monsignor in Butte, and he was head of the church at the time. And I'm pretty sure Monsignor English must have been Irish, but I know we had a Father Bob McCarthy and a Father Malloy who were both priests there at St. Pat's. But I can't remember anything going on as far as
Irish tradition.
Irish tradition. We had our involved. Little green and white shamrock caps that we wore.
So you celebrated all of the regular Catholic feast days.
Right.
And because you were St. Patrick's, you had
St. Patty's Day off.
Yeah. You had St. Patty's Day off, but it... Wasn't treated like the big celebration it is now.
No, it was nowhere near what it was. In fact, it wasn't even what it is now when I first got married. That must have happened later on in maybe the 60s, 70s, somewhere in there where it got to be so big, because I can't remember anything like that when I was little, going to the same guy, even in high school, going to the parade. So.
Okay. How did you... You mentioned that after you got older that you got involved in your own Irish heritage, and I take it you joined the Ancient Order of Hibernians.
I joined the Ancient Order of Hibernians, and through them I met different people, and then at our meetings they'd give Irish history, So that's kind of what jarred me and got me, interested in it. But up to that point I really didn't have a heck of a lot of knowledge about it.
Why did you join the Hibernians?
I'm trying to think who got me into it. Who was my sponsor? It had to be, somebody at work. It was somebody at work that was a Hibernian and said, you know, come on and join this organization, you know. And trying to think of who it was, because I know we had several, like Maloney's, Stanaway, Maloney. Might have been Stanaway.
And was that in Butte or was that in Anaconda?
That was in Butte. I joined the AOH in Butte.
Okay.
And then when I moved from Butte to Georgetown Lake after I retired and I moved up to Georgetown, I transferred to the Hibernians in Anaconda.
And
it was there where I got in with the Pipers and all that stuff and got interested in that.
So that's, you came from a musical family. And you took up the bagpipes on your own?
Yes. Before that, I've had piano lessons. I have had guitar lessons. I took piano lessons, guitar lessons, and bagpipe lessons. And can't play any of them, with the darn.
But well, you're still in with the bagpipes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, still in with the bagpipes. I even have, in fact, there's one over there. I have a couple of Irish flutes that I even wanted to play. One of them my son bought me because he said, you know, I know you want to get involved in this stuff, so, and I don't know where they're at now. One even had music, real easy lessons to play with, and I still haven't learned how to play it. I pick up everything and I learn how to play it till I can play one tune and then I quit. I gotta find out where my flutes are at. I got two of them around here someplace.
Do you think the Hibernians and similar organizations are important to the community?
I definitely do. More important than people realize. The Anaconda just celebrated 125 years of continuous service. And even the Butte Hibernians, we have given, just through dues and some donations, scholarships to Carroll College, to Montana Tech, you know, and maybe not a much. Anaconda's given a lot more than we have. They might give like $2,000 to a scholarship fund, where ours is like $500. But if you go up to Virginia City, for instance, every spring the Hibernians of Helena go up there and redo a home. Now they just recently did the governor's, first governor of Montana, had a house in Virginia City.
Maher's? Maher did?
I don't know if it was Maher.
Oh, no, he was territorial governor.
Yeah. Well, I think it was when they tried to get Virginia City to be a capital or something, and it was governor there, or lived there. I think it was the governor, they said. But the Hibernians, just, they go over there every spring. They pick the weeds, they paint the house, they keep it up. So when you go through that town and look, it's a nice display, old house that you can look at and say, oh yeah, that was, you know, they got a little plaque there. But it's the Hibernians that are keeping that up. You know, if you go down to Anaconda, it's the same thing. The Hibernians are doing so much. Butte, we're the ones that did St. Patrick's Cemetery, if you look at that, with the new fencing, trying to clean it up and get it going, you know, it's the Hibernians. So definitely, they're doing community service that people don't realize, you know, by being a Hibernian, that's where you get involved in doing that. You know, it's not just a social drinking club, you know, it's, they do a lot of good. So, you know, and even the parades in Anaconda, that's the Hibernian sponsor of the parade, the big St. Patrick's Day celebration. And they have, like last month, they had corned beef and cabbage 6 months before St. Patty's, so they had a big dinner for that, in which the whole community, I mean, you go down there and there's 120 people there in the hall. And they have Sarma Night, which is the Slovaks. They're the ones that bake the Sarma, and they have that at the hall. So they all get together with the other nationalities, you know, across their dinners and stuff, so... Yeah, it's really. I think it's really important to have an organization like that.
Was there any involvement with organizations when you were younger? For example, was your family involved with the Knights of Columbus?
No. There was a grocery store on North Washington owned by the Dwyers, and George Dwyer was the timekeeper in the mines, but he was also, he went up through the ranks, like he was one of the chief, what I don't know what they call it,
Grand Knight,
yeah. And I can remember being in the tuxedo and the big hat and everything at the store when he was going to one of the functions. He was the only one in the neighborhood that I knew belonged to the Knights of Columbus, and that was real uppity at that time. the miners, just, you know, my dad, and they didn't belong to the Elks. Mm-hmm. I remember when my older brother joined the Elks, he was probably the first one in the family to ever join anything. And my father, I can't think of any organization that he went to, belonged to, or, you know, even the outdoor, the hunting and that, because he was really involved in hunting and fishing, but he was strictly mostly on his own, you know. Just hunted on his own and going to hunt where I want to hunt and kill what I want to kill. And
you mentioned the local grocery store. So at that time in Butte, I assume you had a lot of neighborhood.
Every neighborhood had a grocery store. And I can remember, like say, the Dwyers that owned ours, the Dwyer Grocery on North Washington. It was in the 300 block. We lived in the 400 block. I can remember when my dad went to Boston and they started paying him monthly rather than weekly. And then once a month, he'd go down and pay off his grocery bill because he could charge. I could walk in there and charge anything I wanted, you know, need a milk, bread, or whatever, and then they'd just charge it out to you. And then at the end of the month, you'd go down and pay off your grocery tab. And that's how they paid bills. I can remember, you know, they had a day when he got paid, and they went around. They paid Hennessy's, the telephone, the water, the groceries, you know.
Made the rounds.
Paid
the bills.
Paid your bills in cash. My father never did have a credit card, and it was real late. My mother was probably in her 70s or 80s before she finally broke down and got a credit card.
Yes.
Everything was on a cash basis. So, in fact, when my father retired, he wanted to buy a boat, and my mother didn't think he should buy a boat. You know, he's in his 64, 65, I think he retired when he was 63. And I asked him, I said, well, you know, I said, the boat's $4,200, which was a lot of money back then. And I said, you'd have the money for it. And he says, oh, yeah, I got the money. I said, well, might as well spend it, or I will. So he ended up buying the boat. But he went down and paid cash for this $4,200 boat. And I thought, God, you know, how much money he's got? You know, well, at that time, he had about $8,000 or $9,000 saved up for his whole retirement. You know, which now you'd be scared to death if that was all he had, was that much, you know. So
the, as you recall your family history, placing it in the context of some historical events, you were born at the end of the Great Depression, because...
Born at the end of the Great Depression, and in 1945, when World War II ended, I was 6 years old, and my cousin and I sold papers to the miners coming off the original shift, because they put out extras. And that's when I was living behind St. Mary's Church on Gagnon Street. And the Butte Daily Post was a daily paper besides the Montana Standard, and they were putting out extras when the war ended. And we went down and bought extras. I probably had 25 cents and went down and bought 10 papers or whatever. And then we came up when the miners were coming out of the gate. At the mines, we were selling them extras for a nickel apiece.
For the end of the war?
End of the war, yeah. They put out the extras that the war is over. And I mean, that was the headline, in fact, the war is over. Big black letters there.
How did the war affect your family?
Life magazine came and did a story on it, took pictures of us, and I haven't been able to find what Life magazine was in, but I had the big pictures. They interviewed the miners in Butte about the war effort, contributing to the war effort. So they felt they were contributing. It wasn't they were dodging it or any by any means whatsoever. They were contributing to the war with the mining that was going on. And of course, my uncle Murray O'Brien, he was a dentist in the army. And that's whose house we lived on Gagnon Street while he was in the service. I don't remember him talking about it. I remember it being on the news, you know, because they had radios. We didn't have TVs back then, but I can remember him sitting around the radio, you know, especially at dinner time. It seemed like, you know, we always had dinner when my dad came home from work from the mines. My mother would always have dinner ready, and then we all sat down, and then I remember they had this little box radio there, and that was always tuned into the news, and you're listening to the war, what was going on. And other than that, I mean, it was typical, you know, you'd sit down and listen to Fibber McGee and Molly and things on the radio at night, you know. Like I say, dark, when it came where it was dark early, you really weren't allowed, when we were real young, to go out and run around too much. So at 6:30, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock at night, we were in the house. You didn't have a TV, so the radio was on, you were sitting around listening to the radio.
So you got the news of real, the Lord.
Yeah, real Norman Rockwell type of family, I think so.
But Butte, because of the critical need for copper during the war, Butte was more involved in producing copper.
Right.
And serving the war effort that way.
Right.
Okay. Does your family have any special food traditions?
Not that go back. I mean, my mother always made a chowder. My dad always called it, you know, Irish chowder, so it's type of thing. And I mean, to this day, you know, we still miss her chowder because she really, you know, we had the typical, you couldn't eat meat on Friday. So my dad was an outdoorsman, so fish, we ate a lot of fresh fish that he caught. He was a hunter, so he grew up on wild meat all the time. But there was no real tradition. You know, Thanksgiving, he did the cooking. That was one tradition.
Mm-hmm.
He did the cooking and the baking, because he was a baker at one time. He had his own bakery.
Oh, okay.
And so come Thanksgiving, that was his day. He did all the cooking and the baking. Yeah, I can remember baking fresh bread and the pies and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So,
did you have turkey?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, put out turkey. We'd always have turkey for Thanksgiving and ham for Christmas. But I just remember Thanksgiving was the day that my dad cooked. And generally, we were out hunting someplace. The kids, when we were teenagers, were getting old enough to hunt, because hunting season was still over Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. And I can remember my uncle, one of the uncles, Marvin, that was my dad's brother. I can remember going hunting Thanksgiving, and with him was like where football is tradition now. A hunting trip with him was Thanksgiving, you know, when you go out. And where we hunted was up behind Big Butte. You go out there, up a couple of those gulches, out Brown's Gulch there and up in there. That's where you did all your hunting. Of course, you didn't have a car that could go through four-wheel drive and go through snow and that, so you didn't wander off too far.
You know? Yeah. Do you have any family heirlooms or keepsakes that you've kept as mementos?
Well, I have one. It's a 3.48 rifle that was my father's, and he gave it to me, and I've since passed it on to my son, so he has it. But yeah, and you can't buy bullets for it anymore, but it's an old Model 71 3.48. And that's pretty much it. You know, family pictures, we've got albums of family pictures and stuff. And
yeah, photo albums.
Yeah,
and
photo
scrapbooks.
Albums. But, yeah. But nothing really. I got a 3.48 shell I kept. I got that.
Well, we talked about you getting involved with the Hibernians. I didn't make real clear was how you actually started getting involved with the bagpipes.
I got involved with bagpipes when I transferred to the Anaconda Hibernians. The Anaconda group was just forming a bagpipe band at that point, and they had a few bagpipers, and they needed someone to be their leader going down the street. And I volunteered for that. I said, oh, I can do that. So I was kind of the guy out in front of the bagpipe band
with
the
baton.
Was just a ragtag. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had white shirts and purchased our own kilts. That was pretty much all we had. And I was out in front. Well, then there was a girl that played in the bagpipe band, and she offered to give free bagpipe lessons if we were interested. So that's how I started in taking bagpipe lessons for her for a year, getting into it. More people heard about it, and more people had gotten into it because she was given free lessons. We picked up probably two or three other bagpipers. And when we played for Governor Judy March's inauguration in Billings, we had 17 people in our group. It was a big bunch at that point. In fact, I don't know if I even have her picture there, but yeah, there was a ton of bagpipers. Probably got it downstairs with my newspaper stuff. Got this one picture here. This was up the Acoma here. This guy, he's a professor at the University of Montana.
Mm-hmm.
Missoula. Joel Strelnick is with the Job Corps deal here, the Job Service. And Dennis Casey's with the State Highway Department. But all these jackets, there was another guy, in this black belsonet. One of the bagpipers, who was a successful plumber down in Belgrade, bought us all those.
He bought the
jackets, all the accessories. He wanted us to look like a group when we started playing. He got into our group. He was a real good bagpiper. And so he bought all the jackets and these pins and the plaids that hang over the top. And then we had to buy our own kilts and stuff.
The group formed about the same time that you joined the Anaconda.
I joined the Anaconda, yeah, 1991, yeah, and that's just about when it started forming, yeah. I joined the Hibernians in 91. I joined Anaconda probably about 95 or 96, so it had probably been a couple of years old. Because all I had was the white shirts. In fact, I still got one in the closet. They had the white shirts and the kilts, and that was their uniform. They didn't have matching socks or anything.
Did you then start listening to more traditional Irish music?
Oh, God, yes. Yeah, I started buying tapes and got several tapes, especially bagpipes, but mostly Irish, you know. We got my grandkids involved in the Irish dancers, you know, the Tiernan dancers come in, and then the Butte local group started teaching Irish dance, so they both got into that. And then, of course, going to all the shows and everything, so. But yeah, that's pretty much, say the Irish, you know, I wish there was more that we had growing up where we did Irish things and I could help you out there, but boy, we just didn't do it. Nobody in the family bragged about being Irish or talked about it.
But you've gotten involved in it.
I've gotten involved in later years after.
And now your grandchildren, for example,
right,
are involved in it. They're taking the step dancing and
right,
the classes.
Yeah. And I was after my son for a while there, but now he's out in Washington, so I haven't been on him too much about getting into it. But my daughter married a Donegan.
Mm-hmm.
They're very involved in the Irish out in Washington. My other daughter that's here isn't, but her daughters are the ones that are in the dancing, and that's so she's involved to that extent. At least they know where their heritage is at, you know, more so than what I did when I was their age.
Yeah, Well, in recent years, we've seen, the Irish Festival and things
right,
like that, Henry Rock.
Yeah, Henry Rock come in here. And
what do you value most about being a bagpiper and with the Hibernians?
Yeah, just the camaraderie. I mean, everybody is pretty much on the same track when you go to one of their meetings. They're all, I'd say, very proud Irish. The fact that when we go to a meeting, they're always looking at what can we do to help the community, what can we do next, you know, go out and mow the grass at a cemetery or help some couple or something. They're donating money for different causes, and it's nice knowing that you get a real good feeling when you do something good, you know, when you do something for somebody else. It's a nice feeling, and especially when you're not being recognized or anything, where you're just doing it, being done with it. And I just like that idea, going down there to those meetings. Everybody's so happy to see you. You're happy to see everybody else. And, okay, what can we do now that's going to benefit somebody?
What do you think is the future of that tradition of bagpiping?
Right now, we're kind of stuttering. We're not getting as many involved in it. But the Anaconda Hibernian organization is still going strong. They have a bunch of young people in it. So I'm hoping that, you know, some of these people are going to realize, you know, hey, the pipers are dwindling down, getting older. We got to get more people involved. Especially now where you still have people that can give them lessons for nothing, you know, and teach them the bagpipe. Some groups, like there's a group up in Polson, I forget what the hell they call them now, they're growing. They're gotten pretty good sized group, and they just started out with one or two guys. They're growing. One of our pipers, this guy here, Rob, he has a bunch down in Missoula playing with him. So, you know, hopefully.
So the piping tradition is carrying,
I think the piping tradition is all, yeah. Whether or not it's Irish or Scottish, because the Caledonians in Billings are a big group, but they're strictly the Scottish group that. You know, the Irish have the Irish washerwomen down there in Anaconda. That's a big group, and they have their they have their Irish washboards, and to symbolize what their grandparents have, they play music on it. But then they have the U.S. flag and the Irish flag on it. Everything on their uniforms, what they wear, what they have, has something, some kind of Irish tradition tied to it. So it's really neat to see that, you know. It's not just a bunch of ladies coming down playing their washboards. You know, like, if you look at the uniforms, what each piece of their uniform means, then you can really appreciate it.
The were there any home cures for ailments or anything that you think might have been connected with an old tradition?
Well, my mother had several, but I'll give you an example. They asked me to take flu shots this year. You know, the VA's giving free. I said, no, you know, I got a great immune system. The reason I have a good immune system is that when my mother was pregnant, her breastfeeding, she drank beer because she said it was good for the kids, which is not the way it is now. You know, you stay away from the alcohol. But yeah, she drank beer all through her nursing, you know, because passing it on because she thought it was good for the kids.
But yeah, wasn't Guinness, though, I don't suppose. It wasn't available then.
Was it? No, it wasn't Guinness. It was probably Great Falls Select or something like that, yeah. But she, I was trying to think about some of the cures. Hot toddies, you know, if we have a cold or something, a shot of whiskey and lemonade or lemon wasn't going to hurt you, you know, we'd have a hot toddy before we went to bed. They had, it wasn't Vicks, but it was something like Vicks that she used to rub all over your chest and put a hot scarf around your neck and give you a shot of whiskey and
put you in bed.
Put you to bed and woke up, you were fine.
Can you think of any superstitions that might have carried?
Oh, God, yes. Yeah, superstitions. Now, she did have those. If a bird flew in the house, it meant somebody in the family was going to die. So she'd have a panic if a bird ever flew in the house or on the back porch. You know, she used to just go nuts. There's some other ones. She passed away in 1999. I have to talk to my sister to find out what the other ones were. But she had several to the point where, you know, they'd drive us nuts. Now that part she got from her Irish family growing up, so but she didn't really, I mean, I guess she passed it on to some extent, but it wasn't taught to us that, you know, this is the Irish way of doing things. It was, but yeah, I'll have to find out from Lynn or Gino what the hell, because I remember she had several. That's what they were, as Irish superstitions.
To wrap this up, I have a couple of questions. One is, what would you say are the most striking changes in your life so far?
Mellowing out from, you know, that comes with everybody's old age, I guess, getting older. I was kind of young and wild, and like everybody. I drank too much and partied too much, and so I mellowed to that extent. This is a good example. I wouldn't leave a dog in the house or on the furniture in my younger days, where this guy's got the run of the place. But as far as when you're growing up, you don't think about dying, you know, like what's going to happen. So you just live your life like, oh, hell, every day's a party, or, you know, nothing to worry about. Then after a couple of illnesses and you realize, hey, you know, we are mortal, you really start appreciating not only your heritage, but your family. You know, like I'm watching the grandkids by myself this weekend. And, you know, it's really, I think it's real neat that they're 15 and 13, and that's what they want to do. They want to come over here and stay with their grandpa, you know. And that's, so that means so much to me, because we have that family, and my first family with my two kids, and my second family with their two kids, all get along great. So when they come over, get together at Christmas time, and that, you know, it's everybody's like one big family. So there's no problems there, which is really nice.
What were your greatest moments of sorrow and joy as you reflect on your life?
Oh, probably, well, of course, death, when your parents pass away and realize, you know, that it's like they say, your life passes before your eyes when you die. Well, it passed before my eyes when they died. You know, I realized, you know, God, I had this whole life with these people, and they were always in my life. Even right to the end, even with just going to pick up medicine and bring it up to him, you know, that was something you always did. You always had your parents there. So when they were gone, that was probably one of the greatest downers. You know, you kind of sinks in that, you know, they're gone. Mm-hmm. I haven't really had that much problems in my life other than my parents passing away and seeing my brother lose two children. And seeing what that does to a family, you know, when you lose your kids, those are really, really moments where you sit down and say a prayer of thanks and for what you have, and not only for what you have, but hopefully that'll not happen to you what has happened to other people. And I really haven't had anything to, you know, I've had illnesses, I broke some bones and stuff like that, but I haven't lost a child or the family member, even one of my brothers, you know, all five of us are still alive, still involved in each other's lives. In fact, my younger brother, taking off for Arizona, he just called me today. And, you know, he and I play golf. My older brother, I'm Kalispell, we get together and play golf, so. But I haven't really had any real downers, like say, other than probably the death of my parents was.
Okay. What do you think the greatest moment of joy?
Oh, God. Several of those, of course. One was when my first daughter was born. And then the next one was when my son was born. And I thought, you know, yippee, I got a boy and a girl. That was probably the most elation I felt I had brought this life into the world. And then several after that, because when I first got divorced, my wife and my oldest daughter didn't have anything to do with each other, wouldn't speak for 5 years, you know, and then to my wife's patience and not being argumentative or anything, finally one Christmas my daughter gave my wife a hug, you know, and at that moment it was like, you know, boy, everything's going to be great, you know. And that's when I went to lunch with today. She came over to the house and picked me up and we went to lunch. She wanted me to go to lunch. So
it's kind of reuniting the family.
Yeah, I'd say any despair, downers, or anything elation had to do with the family. Yeah. You know, just you just look out and think how lucky you are that, you know, you have a family like, say you got two kids that are here, two in Washington. My stepchildren are not my stepchildren, they're my kids, you know, and they look at me as their dad. Yeah. I mean, they call me dad, and the grandkids, of course, I'm grandpa, papa to them. So it's never been a division. When I introduce them to somebody, it's never, this is my stepdaughter, it's always, this is my daughter, this is my daughter, you know. And they're the same way when out there with their friends, we go out to visit them in Washington. Coley's always saying, hi, you know, this is my mom and dad, you know. So
it's all family oriented.
Oh, yeah.
If you were going to write history of the Irish in Montana, what do you think would be important to include for future generations to understand?
Probably the hard work that they've done and what they went through to get here. And I don't know enough about, I know they've had some tough times, the Irish, you know, like they say back in New York and those places where no Irish need apply for jobs and stuff. They were really an underdog, but they had that stick-to-itiveness, we're going to do it and do it. And that's how my uncles were, even in Butte, you know. They were, I hate to say typical Irish because that's not right anymore, but they drank, both uncles. They never missed a day shift, you know. If they were working, they'd go with a hangover, have a hangover cure, but they never missed work. They were hard working. The other thing is that they were really honest. I don't think and boy, if you know, they never squelched on a bet or a debt, as far as everybody I knew. In fact, that was one of the things my dad told me, you know, he says, one thing you have is a good name, don't dare wreck it, you know, or he would come down on it. So you try to live up to that, you know, you say, okay, you know, I don't want to do anything that's going to hurt my father's name or eventually my kid's name. So you try to live as good as decent life as you can. But I would just say, just the fact that they persevered and they were honest and hardworking, and then try to delve into exactly what they did rather than just saying they're honest, what they did to show that they're hardworking and what their, how honest they were in their endeavors, and try to get that out to them. I think, like I say, the Hibernians and Anaconda are doing a terrific job. They've got their young kids, young families involved, and it's the same way. It's all family-oriented down there pretty much. They have their dinners, they have their picnics, they have anything they're doing, whether cleaning the cemetery or whatever, the younger kids are involved in it also, doing the same thing right with them. So I'd like to see Butte get that going, do that more. But, and I should be involved in it myself doing it, but since I've gone through that stage where I went through the ranks and was an officer and everything, and then I figured, well, let it up to the younger guys to do it. So, so, but yeah, I think I'd just try to show them how hard underground mining was. And I didn't realize when my father was an underground miner and raising four or five kids, you know, he'd go out on paydays or something when he was out hunting or something, and he'd tie one on. Now I can understand why. Because hell, he was working 6 days a week mostly, you know, and raising four kids in a four-room house, sending him to a Catholic school on his wages, and hell, no wonder he went out and drank once in a while. You know, I'd probably drink a hell of a lot more. But he still raised a family. He still kept everything together. So, of course, probably a lot of that's my mother, too. But
that good. Even that comes back to family. Then.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much, Terry.
Thank you very much.